About halfway down, liabilities, followed by stockholders' equity. And remember that stockholders' equity is just the difference between the total amount of assets and the total amount of liabilities the firm reports on its balance sheet. By definition, therefore, assets must equal the sum of liabilities and shareholders' equity. Again, assets equals liabilities plus equity. This relatively simple formula is sometimes called the basic accounting equation. Throughout this course, I'll be identifying essential concepts and skills that any business professional should understand. The basic accounting equation is one such concept that should be in your accounting and finance toolkit. The final macro-level observation we should make about the balance sheet is that the assets and liabilities themselves are segregated. They're segregated into two distinct buckets: current and non-current. As you glance at the various categories of assets and liabilities on any balance sheet, you will probably get a sense of what current might mean in the context of a balance sheet. It is actually a hard and fast rule. The dividing line between something that is classified as current on any balance sheet and something that is non-current is 1 year, 12 months. Thus, for example, a current asset is something liquid, something that can or will be used within 1 year. On Intel's 2013 balance sheet, the current accounts receivable is $3.582 billion. That's the amount owed by Intel's customers, the likes of Hewlett-Packard, IBM, and Dell, that are expected to be collected within 12 months following the date of the balance sheet. Simply put, as of the end of 2013, Intel expected to collect $3.582 billion it was owed by customers sometime in 2014. Similarly, all of the current liabilities are amounts that Intel expected to pay to others during the 12 months following December 31st, 2013. Specifically, Intel owed $2.969 billion to its vendors and suppliers as of the end of 2013, which it expected to pay before the end of 2014. By definition, then, anything below current assets are things that are expected to last longer than a year, and items below current liabilities are amounts expected to be paid after 1 year. Not surprisingly, an example of a non-current asset would be property, plant, and equipment, the fixed assets of any organization, while an example of a non-current liability would be any long-term debt, both of which make intuitive sense. Great. Now that we have a sense as to how balance sheets are essentially organized, let's turn our attention to some of the specific items that typically appear on balance sheets, their significance, and perhaps what we should look for or questions we might ask about them. On the asset side of the balance sheet, assets are ordered from the most liquid asset the organization owns to the least liquid, starting with current assets, as we discussed. Thus, on just about every balance sheet you will see, the first asset to appear under current assets will be cash and cash equivalents. Cash is self-explanatory. As for cash equivalents, these are essentially any risk-free securities with a maturity of less than 90 days. Examples might include money market accounts, a 3-month certificate of deposit from a bank, or United States Treasury bill, all very liquid and cash-like investments. Clearly, the cash balance is important, as we want to get a sense as to how much cash the organization has at the end of the reporting period, and of course, how that balance compares to the prior year. In a future lecture, we will be examining and discussing the statement of cash flows, the financial statement which will let us see exactly how and why the cash balance changed from one period to the next. That is one of my favorite discussions, since we know that cash is king, and as Mel Brooks said, it is good to be the king. The other assets that typically make up current assets include marketable securities, any stocks, bonds, or other liquid investments the organization might own. Many organizations own these investments just like we do. You can imagine that we can look at the sum of the cash, cash equivalents, and marketable securities balances to get a sense of the real liquidity an organization might have. Different organizations label these marketable securities differently in their balance sheets. Intel, for example, refers to them as short-term investments. Accounts receivable, which we mentioned earlier, amounts owed the company by its customers, typically follow marketable securities on the balance sheet. You will recall that Intel's balance of accounts receivable at the end of 2013 was about $3.6 billion. But what we didn't mention is a little note on Intel's accounts receivable line. It states, and I quote, "net of an allowance for doubtful accounts," end quote, of $38 million. This is a very important disclosure. So what does it mean? Well, it makes common sense that some customers that owe Intel money may not pay for whatever reason. Maybe a customer hits a financial snag. Maybe there is a dispute about a particular product, shipment, or service provided. There are very few firms, perhaps none at all, that collect all amounts they are owed from their customers. Therefore, under generally accepted accounting principles, organizations must make an estimate as to how much of the total receivables they are owed will not be collected. Here, Intel is estimating they will not collect $38 million on some $3.6 billion of receivables, a little more than 1%. The critical point here is that the allowance for doubtful accounts is a subjective estimate, one of many in the financial statements that we will discuss in our lectures. Presumably, the company is looking at its collection history and the details about the receivables, who owes what, and how long the receivable has been outstanding, in determining what they believe should be the allowance for doubtful accounts. But it is a little bit of a black box, an estimate made by management. So the question for us as users of financial statements is how might management be motivated to potentially misstate the allowance for doubtful accounts or any other estimate they might make in preparing their financial statements? That is, what is the impact of a company understating their allowance for doubtful accounts? The answer is very important. The impact is that the company's reported profits or earnings and the reported earnings per share, which we will discuss in detail in our next lecture, would be overstated. That is not to say that Intel's $38 million estimate is incorrect, just that it is an estimate. As a result, readers of financial statements have to pay very close attention to such estimates to ensure we are comfortable with them. For example, imagine a company whose earnings or profits were likely to fall below Wall Street's expectations. Might management be motivated to reduce the allowance for doubtful accounts to boost earnings? Perhaps. We should at least be sensitive to the possibility that this might occur. Thus, we need to take a close look at the estimate for the allowance for doubtful accounts for all periods that are reported, if just to be sure that the figures appear consistent between the 2 years that are presented. Looking at Intel's balance sheet for 2013, the allowance figures are exactly the same for both 2012 and 2013, even though the accounts receivable balance has decreased by about $250 million. It is hard to draw any hard and fast conclusions here, but the figures are worth noting. One other thing we must look closely at is the change in the accounts receivable from 1 year to the next. This is another crucial analysis for investors and users of financial statements to perform. Remember that accounts receivable represent sales of products or services for which the cash has not yet been received. Thus, the organization has reported the revenue, income, and earnings related to the sale, but they have not yet received the related cash. Perhaps you can imagine a situation where a company is very liberal with its credit terms, allowing customers to take delivery of products, but also allowing them to make installment payments to purchase the products over an extended period of time. Obviously, this could create a real problem if those customers ultimately cannot or do not make those payments. In short, accounts receivable are a wonderful thing, but only if you collect them. To provide an extreme but sadly all too real example, consider subprime loans made by so many banks back in 2006 and 2007. People bought homes using very little, sometimes none, of their own money, with very long-term financing, a 30-year mortgage. We know how that worked out. The banks had huge losses and homeowners lost their homes. Thus, we need to pay very close attention to the accounts receivable balance, changes in the balances over the years presented, and then the allowance for doubtful accounts the company has recorded as a reserve against those receivables. Here, Intel's accounts receivables have decreased by about 6.6% between 2012 and 2013, perhaps reflecting a drop in the sale of personal computers for one reason or another, perhaps a shift to smartphones and tablets. The final current asset on the balance sheet I want to look at is the ever-present other assets. These are the last current assets listed in Intel's balance sheet, which is typical. Now, it just so happens that the most common word you will find in financial statements is indeed the word other, usually appearing several times in the balance sheet alone. There are usually other current assets, other long-term assets, other current liabilities, and other long-term liabilities. Why do we care? Well, what does other mean? I can tell you, and you will be glad to know, that the word other is not any special or advanced accounting term and means nothing more to me than it does to you. Can we tell what these other accounts represent? No, not without looking at the footnotes for more information, if any is provided. What you want to do is to make sure that these other accounts are not material and growing excessively, unidentified growing objects, as I like to call them. If you look at Intel's balance sheet, you will see that the other current other assets are large in absolute terms, more than $1.6 billion in total. But that number is relatively modest in comparison to Intel's total assets of $92.4 billion. Good. If they weren't, I would head immediately to the footnotes for further research. We just want to make sure that the company is not placing assets on their balance sheets that might have no business being there. Let's now take a look at Intel's long-term assets, and specifically, I want to focus on just a couple of line items. Property, plant, and equipment usually comprises the bulk of the longer-term or non-current assets, as we would expect. Every company has them. Intel's balance of fixed assets is over $31.4 billion. The principal issues with respect to any organization's fixed assets are threefold. One, what constitutes something that should be considered a fixed asset? Something that should be reported as an asset on the balance sheet, as opposed to just accounted for as a normal and recurring expense. For example, if you repair a leak in the roof of a building, is that just routine maintenance that should be expensed immediately, or should it be considered part of the building and recorded as an asset on the balance sheet? Obviously, there is some judgment involved here, whether a particular repair really adds to the useful life of an asset or not. However, this simple concept was part of the largest accounting fraud in history. No, not Enron, but MCI WorldCom, in which the company improperly treated at least $9 billion of normal and recurring expenses as fixed assets on their balance sheet. That's right, $9 billion. Essentially, the company was labeling everyday rent expense it paid as a fixed asset. That is, instead of just expensing the rent as is proper, they were acting as though the payments were purchases of an asset. The result was a significant overstatement of reported profits and assets on their balance sheet. The company ultimately filed for bankruptcy, and its top two executives went to jail for accounting and shareholder fraud. Two, how are organizations' fixed assets valued on the balance sheet? What the company paid to purchase them? What they are worth as of the date of the balance sheet? Well, the answer is something else. All fixed assets are accounted for in a unique manner. Since we record them on the balance sheet at their original or historical cost, basically what the company paid for them, and then we depreciate these assets over time. This is true whether the fixed asset is truly something that depreciates, like machinery and equipment, or the company headquarters or other pieces of real estate that the organization might own, which would generally be expected to increase in value over time. In fact, some organizations own lots of real estate, firms such as Sears and Cracker Barrel, and because of the depreciation rules, the real estate assets they own may be significantly undervalued on these organizations' balance sheet. The final consideration regarding fixed assets is how much, on average, the organization is spending each year on fixed assets, commonly called capital expenditures, or CapExes for short. Examples of capital expenditures might include the acquisition of new manufacturing equipment or the purchase of new delivery trucks. As we'll see in a later lecture, capital expenditure estimates are very important to investors who want to value companies and stocks. For now, though, let's turn to a different category of assets, intangible assets. Every organization has them, although they may or may not appear on the balance sheet. Unlike fixed assets, which are clearly tangible, we can see and touch them, intangible assets do not have any physical characteristics. Intangible assets include things like goodwill, brand names, trademarks, copyrights, and patents. Most balance sheets have one or more intangible assets. Sometimes they are listed separately, and sometimes they are combined. Let's take a peek at a different balance sheet for this example, the electronics retailer Best Buy, to see what intangible assets they identify on their balance sheet. In their fiscal 2014 annual report, Best Buy identifies two categories of intangible assets: goodwill and a broad category, intangibles net, which likely includes several different types of intangible assets. We would need to review the footnotes to find out what specific items might be included there. There are a few important comments we need to make about intangible assets. One, generally speaking, organizations only report the intangible assets on their balance sheets that they have acquired from another firm, usually as a part of mergers or acquisitions activity. For example, the goodwill we see on Best Buy's balance sheet is not their internal goodwill that they have created by being in business for a long period of time, but the goodwill they acquired in the process of purchasing some other company or companies. This is generally true about all reported intangibles. Thus, by way of example, if you looked at the Walt Disney Company's balance sheet, you would not see any value there for Mickey Mouse, a Mickey Mouse asset, as it were, even though its value is extraordinary. Same with the brand name associated with Coca-Cola or Tide detergent or Apple. Thus, the balance sheet generally does not reflect each and every asset a company owns, and missing intangibles are one example, perhaps because accountants are just not sure how to value them. After all, how much is Mickey Mouse or the Tide brand worth to Disney and Procter & Gamble, respectively? Until a third party actually pays something for them, something we can measure objectively, generally accepted accounting principles dictate that they remain off of the balance sheet. Okay, that wraps up our discussion about the asset side of an organization's balance sheet. Now let's turn our attention to the liability side, where the first thing we want to do is to examine the total amount of current liabilities. By definition, this is the amount the organization expects to pay within the next 12 months. What we want to do is relatively simple. To compare the amount of cash and current assets the organization has to the amount of current liabilities it owes. What we are looking for is that current assets exceed current liabilities, a quick test we can do to assess an organization's liquidity. For example, take Intel. According to the 2013 balance sheet, the company's current assets total $32.1 billion, while current liabilities total $13.6 billion, a difference of more than 2-to-1. Obviously, Intel has no foreseeable liquidity issues. However, in order to better gauge an organization's risk of insolvency, We also need to closely examine long-term debt, the amount the company has borrowed, and which, by definition, is due to be repaid beyond 12 months. In Intel's case, the company's total long-term debt is $13.2 billion, about the same as last year. Exactly why a company like Intel would borrow so much money is an important question and something we will discuss in a future lecture. Now, I have one other very important point to make about any organization's long-term debt. While we know that any long-term debt has a maturity date beyond 12 months, we cannot tell exactly when it is due. For example, in Intel's case, all we can tell from the 2013 balance sheet is that Intel has debt of over $13 billion that is due sometime after December 31st of 2014. Might it all be due in 2015, 2020, 2050? Does it matter? Of course it does. And this is a really important point. Why? Well, let's go back in time to the financial crisis of 2008, something most of us would most definitely like to forget, but it is important for a particular point I want to make. Imagine it is 2008 and a large company had previously borrowed a significant amount of money that was due in 2010. How would that particular debt be categorized on the company's balance sheet at the end of 2008? The answer is long-term, of course, based on the accounting rule that any liability due beyond 12 months is classified as long-term. However, is the time between December 2008 and the beginning of 2010 really that long term? Of course not. It is only 13 or 14 months, and in 2008, in the midst of a financial crisis, it would be very questionable whether a company would be able to refinance debt maturing in 13 or 14 months. This is not just a hypothetical situation. American Airlines had some $8.4 billion of long-term debt outstanding at the end of 2008, some $6.3 billion of which was due before the end of 2012, not very long-term. Obviously, the financial crisis hit the airlines very hard. American Airlines could not repay or refinance all of its debt and filed for bankruptcy in late 2011. On the other end of the spectrum, the longest-term debt ever issued by a U.S. company is 100-year bonds issued by companies like Walt Disney, Coca-Cola, Federal Express, Ford Motor Company, and even JCPenney. Imagine, 100-year bonds. You need to be pretty optimistic to buy one of those if you want to live to redeem it. Of course, there is no question that this debt is long-term and then some. The issue is that these bonds are classified in the same way as bonds due in 13 months in the balance sheet. Therefore, when considering long-term debt, it is imperative that we review the footnote in the financial statement that deals with long-term debt. This footnote will give us a clearer picture as to when the long-term debt is actually coming due. For Intel, the $13.2 billion in long-term debt is due between the years 2016 to 2042, with nothing very significant coming due in the next few years. Intel's liquidity and their solvency seem well intact, and there appears to be no cause for concern. There is one final issue I want to mention, and that is the concept that some debt a company might have is not listed on the balance sheet at all, something known as off-balance sheet debt. The most common example is operating leases, a typical agreement between a landlord and a tenant. Thus, for example, Best Buy, which leases most of its stores, does not list the value of these long-term leases on its balance sheet as long-term, consistent with generally accepted accounting principles. The same would be true for nearly all retailers, from Walgreens to Walmart to Kohl's. Their long-term store leases are generally not reported on their balance sheets, so we would want to consider these leases when evaluating a company's true amount of debt. Okay, let's summarize the key takeaways about the balance sheet. One, it provides crucial information about an organization's liquidity and risk as of a particular point in time. Two, It is not a statement of market value or organizational net worth because many assets an organization owns and certain liabilities it owes are not reflected at all on the balance sheet. In addition, most assets are not valued at their current market values. 3. The balance sheet, like all financial statements, contains many estimates, and we need to be sensitive to potential impact of these estimates on reported results. And finally, as we glance down the balance sheet, we must investigate any significant changes in account balances from one year to the next, especially in certain accounts like cash, accounts receivable, and long-term debt. I hope that this lecture has demonstrated why the balance sheet is so important to review and analyze, and some of the crucial information it communicates to us. Until next time, we will take a closer look at the income statement.
This lecture is titled, Why the Income Statement Matters.
In the middle of 2002, WorldCom shocked the financial markets when the company announced that it was restating certain previously released financial statements. As I described in our last lecture, the company had improperly transferred billions of dollars of expenses from the income statement to the balance sheet. Without the transfers, not only would the company's reported assets have been much lower, but the company's reported profits would actually have been losses. Immediately following the news, WorldCom's CFO was fired and the controller resigned. Trading in the company's stock was halted, and when trading resumed, the stock plunged over 90%. Within weeks, the firm filed for bankruptcy. Ultimately, both the CFO and CEO went to prison for accounting fraud and securities violations, and eventually it was determined that at least $9 billion in normal and recurring expenses were improperly recorded as assets on the balance sheet, making WorldCom the largest accounting fraud in U.S. history. Why would WorldCom executives have engaged in such patently improper behavior? Obviously, the answer to that question is complex, but the underlying accounting motivation was simple: to make the company appear more profitable than it really was. In fact, during court proceedings related to the fraud, the CFO testified that the CEO pressured him quarter after quarter to, quote, hit their numbers, end quote, that the CEO expected the company to make revenue and earnings figures, two key income statement metrics, match Wall Street expectations. What is the income statement, and what are the information and metrics that it provides? Why do Wall Street analysts and company management alike focus so much of their attention on it? So much so that WorldCom executives were willing to risk just about everything to manipulate it. In this lecture, we are going to take a detailed look at the income statement in order to answer these important questions. Of the financial statements we're exploring together, the income statement is the one most widely followed and cited by the media and investment community. In fact, if you watch or read the business news during certain times of the year, typically during the month following the end of any calendar quarter, the headlines are dominated by company earnings announcements and press releases. Take this example from Apple. Quote, Apple today announced financial results for its fiscal 2014 first quarter. The company posted record quarterly revenue of $57.6 billion and quarterly net profit of $13.1 billion, or $14.50 per diluted share. Gross margin was 37.9%. International sales accounted for 63% of the quarter's revenue, end quote. We should take special note of the key metrics that Apple identifies at the very opening of this press release: revenue, gross margin, net profits, earnings per diluted share, international sales. Each and every one of these metrics is either explicitly disclosed on or derived from the company's income statement. Obviously, both the company and the financial markets consider these metrics to be of paramount significance, and today we'll find out why. You will recall that the income statement details a company's revenue, expenses, and profits during a particular period of time, generally a quarter or year. So let's start our review of the income statement with some discussion as to how income is actually measured under generally accepted accounting principles. As we have already discussed, GAAP requires the use of accrual accounting. As a result, the recognition of both revenues and expenses, and therefore profits, does not necessarily occur when cash is either received or paid out. Revenues are generally recognized when they have been earned and realized, meaning that the company has essentially done what it has promised a customer it will do, and the customer has provided either payment or a promise of payment, an accounts receivable, to the company. However, in practice, there are many complexities involved in revenue recognition. You may recall how we introduced the example of membership dues at Costco in our very first lecture, where that company and all membership clubs are required to amortize annual dues each month, even though they receive the entire annual fee up front. Other industries where the revenue is recognized after cash is received include insurance companies, where customers pay insurance premiums in advance of coverage, and most subscriptions are licenses, including subscriptions for magazines or software. Essentially, in any situation where cash is received up front, but the products or services are delivered afterwards, revenues are not recognized up front, but over time. In many other cases, revenue is recognized before cash is received, when a company provides a product or service to a customer in exchange for payment at some later point in time. Usually these accounts receivable are collected relatively quickly, anywhere from 30 to 60 days after the product is delivered or service provided, though this can depend on the particular circumstances. A simple example would be a healthcare provider, which may provide medical services to a patient well in advance of when they actually get paid by Medicare, a private insurance company, or the patient him or herself. Revenues are recognized once the service is provided, regardless of when the cash is ultimately received. Similarly, expenses can be recognized in different ways and at different times, depending on the particular circumstances. Generally speaking, expenses are matched with their underlying revenues to provide as accurate a profit picture as possible. For example, cost of goods sold, shipping costs, and commissions should be allocated or matched to the revenues to which they relate. Other expenses can be systematically and rationally allocated or spread out over time. For example, the cost of buildings and equipment is expensed or depreciated over time, the estimated period during which they will be in use. Finally, some expenses that are not tied to specific revenues are immediately recognized. These would include most administrative costs, selling, marketing, and advertising expenses. One other example in the United States includes research and development costs, simply because the future benefit of such expenditures is highly uncertain, and thus the more conservative treatment is to expense them immediately. The important point to note here is that revenue and expenses can be recognized at different points in time, depending on the facts and circumstances, and they may or may not be closely tied to the actual receipt or payment of cash. Different firms and industries have different practices and protocol, but our discussion so far reveals some important guidelines for accountants everywhere. Revenues must be earned and realized. Expenses must be matched with revenues. And when in doubt, be conservative in recognizing revenue or income. With these guidelines in mind, let's turn to the actual organization and structure of the income statement. Just like all the financial statements we will discuss in this course, there are many variations in the financial statement titles, terminology, and the level of detail provided, but income statements report the same basic type of information and are similarly organized. The starting point for any income statement, the so-called top line, is revenue. Revenue is the amount of sales to customers that an organization generated during the particular financial reporting period, reduced by any sales returns or other discounts. Underneath revenues, a typical income statement provides what is known as cost of sales or cost of goods sold, often called COGS for short. There are three things that make up COGS: direct labor, direct materials, and manufacturing overhead. Direct labor is the labor used in the process of manufacturing a company's products, or for service providers like law firms, the cost of personnel directly involved in the delivery of services to customers. Direct materials are the cost of the raw materials included in the particular goods sold. And finally, manufacturing overhead includes certain indirect costs that are allocated to the products sold. Such overhead might include things like the rent, insurance, and utilities related to the manufacturing plant where the company's products are made. Subtracting cost of goods sold from sales provides the first important and commonly cited subtotal in income statements: gross profit or gross margin. Most firms disclose the gross margin explicitly on the face of their income statements, while others don't. In those cases, however, it is easily calculated. Many accountants and analysts use the reported gross margin to compute something known as the gross margin percentage. To compute the gross margin percentage, you take the amount of reported gross margin in dollars divided by the sales revenue, again reported in dollars, which gets you a percentage. For example, if a company reported revenues of $1 million and gross margin of $300,000, we would say that the gross margin percentage is 30%, the $300,000 in gross margin divided by the $1 million of revenue. The gross margin percentage provides a widely cited measure of profitability and allows for comparisons between different periods of operations and between different companies. For example, once we calculate the actual gross margin percentage, we'd want to compare this percentage to prior year's results, as well as to competitors, to see if the percentage is improving or not over time, and to benchmark reported results. Knowing how to compute a firm's gross margin percentage should be in any investor or business person's toolkit. Following gross margin on the income statement, firms deduct other costs and expenses, generally known as operating expenses. They include almost all other costs and expenses not included in cost of goods sold, and include things like selling and marketing costs, delivery expenses, most depreciation, and finally, expenditures on research and development. As a rule of thumb, operating expenses generally range from 15 to 20% of revenues, although that depends on the particular company or organization. And as firms grow larger, they are usually able to reduce this percentage of operating expenses as they experience economies of scale and are able to leverage their larger sizes. The next subtotal on a typical income statement is operating income or loss, often called income or loss from operations, which is the result of deducting operating expenses from gross margin. It is often referred to as EBIT, E-B-I-T, or earnings before interest and taxes. In my opinion, operating income or EBIT is the single most important disclosure we need to examine from the income statement. By its very name, this figure is intended to provide us with the amount of income or loss an organization actually generated from its normal and recurring activities, what it does for a living. While revenues are extremely important, to be sure, they ignore operating expenses that could theoretically more than eliminate reported sales figures. You can imagine a firm with really high sales but with really high expenses. For example, take Amazon.com, a very large retailer we are likely all familiar with, which sells just about anything and everything. In 2013, Amazon reported revenues of $74.5 billion and gross margin of $20.3 billion. However, Amazon's total other operating expenses in 2013 were over $19.5 billion, or almost equal to the total amount of the company's gross margin. Amazon is clearly spending a lot of money on sales and marketing expenses, likely trying to increase its market share. However, it is coming at a cost, and that is very high operating expenses and therefore very low operating margins. In fact, if you divide Amazon's operating income by its total revenues, you only get about 1%, a very small figure. By comparison, Walmart's 2013 operating income was 6% of revenues, a much higher figure. These results could be very relevant to investors or prospective investors in either or both companies. Following operating income, a typical income statement will disclose any other non-operating income or expense the firm may have. This might include things like interest income the company may have earned on its investments, and any interest expense the company may have incurred on outstanding debt. In any case, because these numbers are not related to what an organization does day to day, they appear below operating income, or what is often called below the line. To the extent a company has other income or losses during a particular period that are not related to daily operations, maybe the gain or loss realized from the sale of certain equipment, these two are reflected in this particular section of the income statement. So, to reiterate, income statements begin with net sales or revenues, then they deduct cost of sales resulting in gross margin. Next, we subtract various operating expenses, leading to operating income. We then add or subtract the so-called below-the-line income or expenses, which gives us the next line on the income statement, income before taxes. So what would we expect to find next on an income statement? Income taxes, of course. Let me make a few brief but important comments about income taxes, clearly a material item in just about any income statement we might examine. One is that the income tax expense in income statements is not equal to the taxes paid during the year. Why not? Well, the reason is good old accrual accounting again. Just like we must use accrual accounting for all other revenues and expenses appearing in the income statement, the same goes for income taxes. As a result, the income tax expense reflected in income statements is not simply what we owe in taxes right now, what appears as the taxes due on the tax return. It also includes any future tax consequences of revenues and expenses we are reporting today. It is a very complex area in accounting, but for now, the key takeaway is to understand that income tax expense is not equal to income taxes paid. The second thing to remember about income tax expense is that it captures all of an organization's income taxes, federal, state, local, and even international for those firms doing business globally. Because most foreign countries have lower corporate tax rates than the United States, we will generally find that the actual tax rate in an income statement is less than the statutory corporate tax rate here in the U.S., currently 35%. This has become a very controversial topic, as many U.S. companies generate profits overseas but do not bring the cash back to the U.S. in order to avoid paying taxes here on those overseas profits. Other U.S. firms have actually reincorporated abroad, literally becoming foreign companies, just to reduce their U.S. taxes, something called a tax inversion. For better or worse, the Cayman Islands and Bermuda seem to be attractive new domiciles for U.S. companies. The final thing to keep in mind regarding income taxes is that it is possible that the income taxes could actually be a positive figure, what is known as an income tax benefit, as opposed to an expense. Usually this happens when companies are reporting losses from which they can actually benefit under corporate tax law. As an example, in 2009, Lennar, one of the largest home builders in the United States, received an $800 million tax refund from losses it incurred during the housing crisis. That's right, an $800 million tax refund. Even H&R Block could probably not do better than that. Okay, back to the income statement. Once taxes are deducted from the income before taxes, the result is, as would be expected, net income, often called the bottom line. While the bottom line is certainly important and widely cited in the popular press, it might include one-time income or expenses that are not part of recurring operating results, which are what we really want to understand and evaluate. And that is why I consider operating income to be important, as I mentioned earlier. The final disclosures on the face of the income statement are earnings per share, literally the net income divided by the weighted average number of shares of common stock outstanding during the period. Again, earnings per share are widely cited and disclosed by investors, analysts, and the media as a barometer of financial performance, usually compared to or benchmarked against Wall Street expectations. Note that there are two earnings per share figures, basic and diluted. Basic earnings per share include only the shares of common stock that are currently issued and outstanding. But what if the company has issued stock options to its employees, options that could become shares of stock in the future if employees exercise them? Well, diluted earnings per share try to capture the estimated impact of not only stock options, but any other securities the company has that might become shares of stock in the future. Convertible bonds, bonds that are convertible into shares of stock, are another example and something we will discuss in a future lecture. By definition, therefore, the diluted earnings per share figure must be less than or equal to basic earnings per share. Diluted earnings per share are the one most closely watched by investors and Wall Street analysts. Now that we've identified the typical elements of an income statement, I would like us to examine Apple's 2013 income statement as an example for us to apply what we just discussed. Now, the very first line of the statement is net sales, which amounted to $170.9 billion for the year ended September 28, 2013, up from $56.5 billion in the prior year. Wow, that is a lot of iPhones, iPads, and iTunes downloads. The income statement next discloses that Apple's cost of goods sold were $106.6 billion. Subtracting COGS from net sales, and you get gross margin of $64.3 billion. Now let's calculate the gross margin percentage. Remember, to do that, we divide the gross margin, the $64.3 billion, by the net sales of $170.9 billion. The result is a gross margin percentage of 37.6%. In this case, Apple's gross margin percentage has fallen sharply from the previous year when it was 43.9%. So while Apple's revenues increased from 2012 to 2013, the COGS increased at an even faster rate, leading to a drop in the gross margin percentage. As an investor or potential investor, we would want to understand what is driving this decline. Greater competition resulting in lower prices, higher manufacturing costs, a change in the mix of products the company is selling, trending to lower margin products, all of these factors. As you can see, some relatively simple calculations lead us to ask some critical business questions about Apple, and to think about what might happen looking into the future. As we make our way down the income statement, we find that Apple discloses two broad categories of operating expenses: research and development, and selling, general, and administrative costs. Obviously, these are fairly broad categories. Total operating expenses for 2013 were $15.3 billion, consisting of $4.5 billion of research and development and $10.8 billion of selling, general, and administrative expenses. By subtracting operating expenses from the gross margin, we get Apple's operating income. And immediately below that, Apple discloses other undefined income and expenses net of about $1.2 billion. Obviously, without digging deeper into the financial statement footnotes or elsewhere, we simply cannot be sure what this figure represents. In fact, this is one of the things I think you should be sensitive to in all financial statements. Words like other and net pervade financial reporting, and yet without details and some sort of breakdown, it is impossible to know what these figures refer to, no matter how strong one's accounting and finance background. Finally, the income statement reveals that Apple's 2013 income tax expense is $13.1 billion on pre-tax income of $50.2 billion. That's a tax rate of about 26.2%, well below the top corporate rate in the U.S. of 35%. This lower rate reflects both Apple's global footprint and certainly some effective tax planning. Net income is a tad over $37 billion, resulting in basic and diluted earnings per share of $40.03 and $39.75 respectively, a difference of less than 1%. Other companies have far greater differences, generally those that have been more generous with employee stock options, for example. Okay. So we've now discussed the structure of a typical income statement, from sales all the way down to the bottom line and earnings per share. At this point, I want to mention four key questions we should answer regarding any income statement we might review. One, is the company profitable or not? Obviously, we can't draw black and white conclusions from the bottom line, since we might expect some firms to report losses, like startups or biotechnology firms still performing research and development, while other firms may be reporting profits, but not as much as investors and Wall Street would like. Regardless, it is a key piece of data on any income statement. Two, what is the company's gross margin, and how does it compare to both the operating income or loss and that bottom line? As we saw with Amazon.com, they incurred such high operating expenses that there were substantial differences between gross margin and operating income, and we need to be sensitive to how gross margins and even operating income can evaporate quickly with high expenses as we move down the income statement. Three, how do the results compare to the prior period? Are they improving, getting worse? In Apple's case, we see that while the nearly $49 billion in 2013 operating income and $37 billion in net income are very positive, these figures have actually declined since last year, after increasing sharply between 2011 and 2012. This could certainly be a cause for concern for both current and prospective Apple investors, management, and other concerned constituents, as we wonder whether that downward trend will continue, or whether Apple can once again begin to grow. And finally, do the reported results show any consistent trends? Because we are generally evaluating historical financial results and accounting disclosures to predict the future, it is important that we get a sense of how consistent past results have been. With Apple, we don't have that consistency at this point. This is why we cannot immediately jump to any conclusion as to the value of Apple stock as a potential investment. In future lectures, we will take a deeper dive in analyzing historical results in an effort to better predict the future and perform valuation analyses. Now, while the income statement figures in and of themselves are very important, we also will be using the disclosed figures for additional computations and analyses. For example, for the numbers on the income statement, we are able to calculate a significant and common measure called EBITDA. E-B-I-T-D-A. An acronym for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. You might ask why one would need to compute or utilize a metric beyond those that are already on the face of the income statement. Remember that the income statement not only reflects normal and recurring operating expenses, but also the impact of a company's financing choices. For example, what if you had two companies with exactly the same sales and operating expenses, but one had financed its business entirely with debt and the other solely with investor equity? The one that was funded with debt would show significant interest expense and thus much lower income before taxes, and therefore lower net income. Should that company be worth less as a whole than the company funded entirely with stock? Just like the value of your houses does not depend on the amount of your mortgage, the answer is generally no. This is a very important concept that we will return to in a future lecture. For now, we can just appreciate that a firm is not worth less as a whole because it has decided to fund its business with debt. And because EBITDA is a metric before interest expense, it will help us make comparisons between firms, ignoring how they might have funded operations. The easiest way to compute EBITDA is to take the operating income or loss taken directly from the face of the income statement and add back depreciation and amortization expense. Again, operating income or loss plus depreciation and amortization expense. Depreciation and amortization expenses are separately disclosed in the statement of cash flows, which we will be discussing in our next lecture. Knowing what EBITDA is and how to compute it are important additions to our toolkits. Okay, so what are the key takeaways with respect to the income statement? One, we need to understand its general structure from top-line revenues to the bottom-line net income and the various subtotals in between, namely gross margin, operating income, and earnings before taxes. Two, reported income or loss can differ significantly from actual cash flows thanks to accrual accounting, something we will discuss in depth in our next lecture. Three, knowing how to compute the gross margin percentage and EBITDA are two things all investors and business people should have in their toolkits. And finally, the next time you are reading or watching the business news and they are discussing earnings per share, which happens very routinely throughout certain times of the year, you will know where to find this very important metric. In fact, there is no question that the income statement is the financial statement that gets the most attention from Wall Street to Main Street, and with good reason. It provides a lot of critical accounting and financial information to investors, creditors, and management alike. In hindsight, it is no wonder that WorldCom worked as hard as it did to manipulate its reported income and earnings per share, despite the tragic outcome for all involved. Well, that wraps up our discussion of the income statement. Until next time, when we will be discussing the statement of cash flows. Thank you.
This lecture is titled, How to Analyze a Cash Flow Statement.
In 2010, Green Mountain Coffee, the specialty coffee maker best known for its individual K-cups, reported record sales of $1.36 billion and net income of nearly $80 million, increases of some 73% and 46% from the previous year. Very, very impressive financial results. However, at the same time, the company bled cash from operations, actually losing money from its core business, about $2.3 million. In the next year, 2011, the company generated $2.7 billion of revenues and nearly $200 million in net profits, another year of tremendous growth. And yet, the company's cash flow from operations was a paltry $785,000 during the year. Obviously, in both years, the company reported significant differences between net income and actual cash flows. Let's compare these results to Apple. Apple's 2011 net income was about $26 billion, and their cash flows from operations over $37 billion. Again, net income of $26 billion, and operating cash flows, $37 billion. Cash flows were much higher than reported profits. How can that be? How can one company, Green Mountain, report substantial revenues, profits, and growth, and yet not generate any real cash flow, even as another company, Apple, shows cash flows that are much higher than the reported profits? How can we reconcile these two seemingly inconsistent data points? In this lecture, we strive to answer these important questions as we analyze the statement of cash flows, perhaps the most important financial statements we will be discussing in this course. Why is the statement of cash flows so important? First and foremost, it allows us to bridge accrual accounting and its impact on reported revenues and profits with actual cash flows. The Green Mountain and Apple examples clearly demonstrate that an income statement may simply be inadequate for shareholders and others to completely assess a firm's financial performance. The second reason that the statement of cash flows is so important is that the value of any asset, stocks, bonds, or a piece of income-producing real estate, should be the current or present value of the cash flows we expect the specific asset to generate in the future, something we will be discussing at length in the finance section of this course. That is, think about the value of a bond and what we would expect to pay for it. It should be worth what we expect to receive in cash from the bond issuer over the life of the bond, interest payments, and our principal back, all put in today's dollars. The same thing is true for the value of a stock, whether it is Apple or Green Mountain Coffee. It should be the value of the cash flows each company is expected to generate over time, after paying off all of its debt. Notice we refer to valuation in the context of cash flows and not revenues or net income. While revenues and profits are very important accounting and financial metrics, cash really is king when we are talking about valuation. We will discuss this in detail in the finance section of this course. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty details regarding the statement of cash flows, let's step back and try to understand why there are differences, and sometimes substantial differences, between revenues, profits, and cash flows. If we think back to our discussion of the income statement, we hopefully remember two macro-level points. One is that there are certain non-cash expenses that appear in the income statement and reduce profits. For example, think about depreciation expense. We take the initial investment in a building or a piece of machinery and expense it over time. Those periodic expenses reduce reported profits, but are non-cash. Thus, to reconcile between reported net income and actual operating cash flows, we need to add back these sorts of non-cash expenses. Secondly, organizations following generally accepted accounting principles typically record revenues upon the delivery of the product or service to customers. While collectability of any amounts owed by the customer must be reasonably certain, the customer may or may not ultimately make good on amounts they owe if they do not make payment at the time of the sale. Most companies require that customers pay their receivables within 30 to 90 days following a sale. Take Procter & Gamble, the multinational consumer products company which sells everything from Crest toothpaste to Pampers diapers. On average, Procter & Gamble collects their receivables from their customers, the Walmarts, Costcos, and Targets of the world, in about a month, fairly quickly. On the other hand, you could have companies providing longer-term financing to customers. For example, Cisco, the large networking equipment manufacturer, has been known to allow customers up to 3 years to pay. What does all of this mean? In simple economic terms, companies generally report and record revenues and profits before they collect the cash. If the time lag is only a few months, maybe this is not a big deal. But what if it takes longer than that? Or what if the customers ultimately don't pay at all? You can imagine how companies like Cisco performed during the dot-com bubble in the late 1990s, or how home builders and banks performed in the mid-2000s. Initially, they reported fantastic revenues, profits, and earnings per share. But ultimately, they ended up taking big losses when customers did not pay as expected. In one extreme example, Lucent Technologies, a telecommunications equipment manufacturer, failed to collect on over $5 billion of receivables it reported in the late 1990s and early 2000s, before the dot-com stocks crashed and many of their customers went out of business. And take our Green Mountain Coffee example, where we saw the company report a tremendous growth in revenues and profits, but very different and, in fact, far lower cash flows. Perhaps you can already imagine why this difference might have occurred. The company sells their machines, the actual coffee makers, to department stores and other retailers, providing liberal credit terms, allowing these customers to pay off the receivables over an extended period of time. So long as Green Mountain expects to ultimately get paid and receive the cash, they can record the revenue and the profits today. But there would then be a potentially large discrepancy between these profits and the actual operating cash flows of the company, at least in the short run. Then how do we explain the Apple situation, where their cash flows were actually higher than reported net profits? Well, there are two things to consider with Apple. One, Apple typically receive cash when they sell their products. Generally speaking, much faster, since the company sells most of their products directly to customers visiting their stores. We pay for the product right away and leave with the product in hand. Obviously, the company also sells their products through other retailers like Verizon and has to wait for the cash in those cases, but overall, they collect their receivables fairly quickly on average, in about 27 days. In addition, because Apple has so many stores in which it invests lots of capital, the company has reported a fair amount of depreciation expense, again, a non-cash expense, which reduces reported profits and yet has no impact on the company's cash flows. Thus, for companies with really high depreciation and amortization costs, the actual operating cash flows can be higher, and substantially higher, than reported profits. Therefore, one of the things we are going to want to do when evaluating companies and their financial statements is to compare reported accrual-based profits and cash flows. What we want to do is to see if a close relationship exists between the two. Okay, so now that we have at least some understanding as to how and why reported profits can differ from cash flows, let's discuss how the statement of cash flows is structured, and specifically what it discloses. Overall, the statement of cash flows lays out both the source